This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan. The fraud cases are underway. The recounts are underway. The president still has not conceded. And the question for most of us is, who do we believe? And for that, we've turned to Kate Starbird, who is the director of the Emerging Capacity of Mass Participation Laboratory at the University of Washington. This, by the way, is the Kate Starbird, once of the Seattle Storm, excellent basketball player. So Emerging Capacity of Mass Participation sounds like you study viral media, right?
Well, we've been studying this since about August, and we've been looking at a lot of these incidents or claims or what we call false narratives about voter fraud in real time, analyzing them as they emerge online and as they spread and watching them spread. And we could see the right-wing media and some Trump supporters already laying the foundations for claims of voter fraud starting in June, but certainly from August and September, priming people for what we've been seeing from election night and onwards.
Well, then how do you create trust? Because you have voting is a unique situation, right? So if somebody tries to commit bank fraud, somewhere there's a signature, somewhere there's a digital record. But by its very nature, ballots are supposed to be private. And so once the ballot's removed from the envelope, there's supposed to be no identifying information. So you can't go back and find that voter and say, well, did you really mean to color this in? I can check and find out that my ballot was received and the envelope was opened and the ballot was counted. But there's nothing that says, and it is confirmed that you voted for candidate A or B. So how do you create trust in that kind of environment? Isn't this always going to be a problem?
This is an integral part of our democracy, is that we trust the results of the election. If we can't trust the results of our elections, we don't have a democracy. If we don't have peaceful transfer of power, we don't have a democracy. That's what democracy is really all about. There have been cases of fraud in the past that are usually small. But what we've seen in this election is not an attempt to strengthen our trust in the process or to make the process more trustworthy. What we've actually been seeing is a concerted effort to undermine our trust in the process. That makes democracy weaker. That pushes us towards more authoritarian leadership styles. And we've seen that happen in other countries. And so, yeah, there is, it's easy to undermine our trust and make us think, I can't track my ballot. Oh, someone might have changed something. Oh, there's a ballot in the ditch somewhere. Therefore, we can't trust the process. If we think there's something wrong that we want to make stronger in the future, let's go do that. But let's not just poke holes in our process and make it so we can't trust the results. That's more of a political strategy than actually something that's noting an actual problem in our process.
You're familiar with how they vote in Canada, right? In Canada, they all get together in a room and they just take out paper ballots and people hand them in and they count them in the presence of the people who actually vote, post the results on a board. Then you can go back and check to make sure those results are accurately reported. You rarely hear of anybody protesting the outcome in Canada because it all takes place in the open. We've gone to a mail-in system, which I think is great. It's really convenient. But once you place that ballot in the slot, since you don't know where it goes, you become prey to basically any story somebody wants to make up, I guess, depending on whether you win the election or not.
One of the things I've learned about misinformation and disinformation is there's no amount of transparency that makes you resistant to disinformation. Mm-hmm. It can always find a way to poke holes in something, use some scrap of something to create a false narrative and then double down on it. I don't think this is about the security of our elections. I think this is about a political moment, a growing distrust in our institutions, in part as a political strategy from both foreign and domestic actors that have been sowing distrust in our processes for a few years now. I think it's really important that our leaders, but also our leaders in media and every one of us, whoever we are, that we all work together to restore trust in these processes and not be working to break them down. It's not just our political leaders. It's being driven by media elites, especially around some hyperpartisan media. And if mm-hmm. the hyperpartisan media outlets would start saying that they're not falling for these false narratives, I think a lot of the people that pay attention to those media elites will follow them as well. So
the only thing that would stop, we're talking about Fox. The only thing that would stop Fox from pushing this is if there was some sort of penalty.
Viewers, sponsors, there's some ways to hold that accountable. People that work within the organization. And we should talk about Fox in two different ways right now, because the Fox daytime news hasn't done that poor of a job this time. Their election night coverage was
Trump hates them now.
Good. Yeah. So I would now they're primetime folks. That's not news. That's opinion. Yeah. And they have absolutely been feeding these narratives. We you know, one day we'll sit there, we'll go through all these false rumors that come up, and we've been batting them down all day, talking about how they're not true. And that night we'll see them all on Hannity.
So in your mass participation lab there at the University of Washington, have you mixed up a magical potion of some sort that can serve as an antidote to this kind of misinformation?
I wish we had an antidote. What we have are we can do some pre-bunking.
Pre-bunking,
we did offer a report,
yes.
a report about a week before the election of like, this is what's going to happen. There's going to be uncertainty. There's going to be lies about voter fraud. And it like kind of played out almost exactly as we put out there. And I think there's some benefits in telling people ahead of time what they're going to see, and telling them why they're going to see it. And then, you know, to give them a sense of like, don't fall for this. This is coming. But even that isn't enough for people that are really, you know, whose political biases align with the misinformation. It makes them really vulnerable to grabbing onto that.
Well, I think fact checkers have done a good job. I mean, every time a listener sends me an allegation, I Google it, and it leads directly to a very well-researched and sourced fact check showing why it's wrong. But the fact is that most people who share stuff on social media do not Google or Bing before they share. They just share it assuming it's true.
Well, one of the things we have is confirmation bias, and we're all very good critical thinkers and we're good researchers. We only do research on the things we don't like. So you're much more likely to look up a fact check on something that you already don't believe than you are on something you do believe.
Yeah.
And so, right, those fact checks are being surfaced by people who already were skeptical of them. And the folks that are seeing this stuff and believe it, and it lines up with their priors, and it makes them feel good and self-righteous and in some ways and angry at the results, they're not going to look at the fact check. They're just kind of absorbing it. And right now there's so much, it's not just one narrative. There's so many narratives. I was talking about it as under a smoke machine, like they're blowing smoke, so much smoke in there that people are confused and they think there must be a fire somewhere. And it's really just a smoke machine coming at people from all sides. And so you can swat down one narrative, but then they're like, well, there's these six others. Well, you can actually swat down all those six, but it just takes so much time. And people that are trying to make sense of this information space, they're getting bamboozled.
Yeah. You have to practice safe sharing. It's like wearing a virtual mask. You fact check your stuff before it leaves your keyboard. And if you receive stuff that hasn't been fact checked, then distance yourself and don't inhale.
And instead of fact checking the stuff you don't like, go fact check the stuff you do like. Go fact check the stuff that you think must be true.
Yeah.
And that's what you really should be doing. That's where you're going to find stuff that tries to confront some of your cognitive biases.
Yeah. Kate Starbird, who directs the Emerging Capacity of Mass Participation Laboratory at the University of Washington. Kate, thanks a lot.
Right, thank you.
This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan. With the explosion in coronavirus, which was predicted, the question comes up, for people who don't end up in the hospital, what can they expect from this? Let's call in the doctor.
Paging Dr. Cohen.
Dr. Gordon Cohen, MD. Fortunately, most of the cases, Dr. Cohen, are going to be mild, will not require hospitalization. So what can people who get it expect?
Right, Dave. So, you know, there's been a lot of discussion about this from day one, trying to really characterize what the disease or the infection could look like. And obviously, we've learned that it's quite varied in within the population of people who actually get it. And it seems to be somewhat age related, but not entirely. We were originally being told that kids really don't get sick, and it's only elderly adults who get sick, and it's the elderly adults who die. But I don't think we really understand completely why that's the case. One of the things that's clear is there are a lot of people that are asymptomatic, a lot. So in terms of, you know, what it could look like having absolutely no symptoms, mm-hmm. to having symptoms that are really more consistent with a cold or some other type of viral illness. Some people will just have, you know, a low-grade fever and some chills, or maybe a little bit of a cough, maybe some very mild shortness of breath. One of the things that I've heard people report the most is that they just feel so tired. People may have muscle or body aches, which is very common when you have a viral illness. There's been a lot of talk about this loss of taste or smell. But again, a lot of people don't really experience that. So a lot of people are getting just these mild symptoms, and And they would only be diagnosed at this period in time because of the increased awareness of COVID, and people are going in and actually getting tested.
Which brings us to this latest study on why this thing spreads, even among people who do follow the rules. It was conducted among Marine recruits, and if anybody's going to follow rules, it would be Marine recruits. And yet they still found that it was very difficult to stop the disease from spreading. So let's tell me what that study found.
It's very interesting. The study was published in the New England Journal of Medicine, so it's really a high-quality study. It's interesting because when we go into various businesses now or doctor's offices or whatever, what do? They have you wait at the door. They come over and they take your temperature, and they ask you if you have any symptoms that would be consistent with having a coronavirus infection. But what this study demonstrated is that, well, maybe that's not really doing anything at all, that doing temperature and COVID-19 symptom checks are really inadequate for spotting a coronavirus infection. It was done on Marine recruits who were going to go through training. And it's actually a pretty large group. There was almost 3,500 new Marine recruits, and they did a two-week home quarantine before arrival. And about half of the recruits agreed to participate in a study. But what they ended up finding is that they tested people at different times throughout the two-week period. And they found that there was an increase, the spread of the infection, irrespective of whether or not people had symptoms, based on whether they were assigned to a similar platoon or whether they shared a room with somebody who was infected. And so they actually saw a pretty impressive increase in the number of people who were getting infected because very few of them were actually symptomatic. And they found that there were actually six different strains of the virus. So the infection was spreading irrespective of all the testing they were doing and looking for temperature increases and changes in symptoms. We're going to have to focus on a combination of really good public health measures, temperature checks, which we're doing, but we don't know if they're going to be that effective. Mask wearing, which we're doing, but, you know, it's probably the most effective thing. Social distancing, it's unclear how much that helps because, you know, these guys and girls were subject to really very strict social distancing, good hygiene, hand hygiene, and a vaccine that's effective that we can actually get everybody to take, and some therapeutics that are going to be what get us through this crisis.
Dr. Gordon Cohen, MD. Dr. Cohen, thank you.
Thanks, Dave.
The big story of the COVID restrictions announced by the governor, they're going to hit some industries harder than others, and of course there are some calling on the governor to reconsider. At the same time, one important industry is celebrating. Let's go back to Hannah Scott.
During a rare Sunday morning news conference where the governor announced new restrictions, State Health Officer Dr. Kathy Lofi explained the dire situation.
During the past 2 weeks, the number of cases reported each day in our state has more than doubled from about 1,000 cases reported per day to more than 2,200 cases reported per day. If that doubling time continues, in two more weeks, we'll be seeing over 4,000 cases per day.
On top of that,
especially concerning is that during the past week, the number of patients currently in our hospitals with COVID-19 increased about 40%.
And it's those hospitalizations and exponential growth that the governor says warranted the swift action on new restrictions that, though are not quite as severe as the initial lockdown, will have a significant impact.
Indoor social gatherings with people from outside your home are prohibited unless they quarantine for 14 days prior to the social gathering, or quarantine for the 7 days prior to the gathering and receive a negative COVID-19 test result no more than 48 hours prior to the gathering.
Religious services will be limited to 25% capacity or 200 people, whichever is less. Weddings and funerals can't have receptions, but services can be allowed with no more than 30 people. Bowling alleys, gyms, movie theaters, museums, zoos, and aquariums all closed to indoor services. Most long-term care visits will have to be outside. Hairdressers, barbers, and nail salons will have 25% capacity. And all in-store retail, including grocery stores, will have to be 25% capacity. All of those restrictions take effect at midnight and were welcome news to medical workers across the state.
I fear a lot for what the next few months will look like.
Without action, we may not be able to continue to offer care for both COVID patients and offer some medical services and non-urgent surgeries as well.
It's become frighteningly out of control very quickly. I think we need to make some sacrifices in order to get things under control again, to keep our hospitals and our healthcare system so that it's not overwhelmed.
Other restrictions take place Wednesday at midnight. They ban indoor service for restaurants and bars. They can still do to-gos and serve outside with no more than 5 people a table. Not doable for many smaller family-owned bars and restaurants, according to Chad McKay, CEO of Fire and Vine Hospitality, which operates El Gaucho and many other restaurants in the state.
There'll be a lot that have problems ever reopening, but there's going to be some federal program that will come, right? That will happen. It's just not going to happen tomorrow. But what is going to happen tomorrow or Wednesday is layoffs. What I'm concerned about is the teams and the loss of their jobs.
McKay says there's no evidence that restaurants and bars are to blame for the spike, but we do know.
Where are people getting it? We know they're getting it from gatherings in their house, in private events.
He's calling on the governor to reconsider.
The reality is, whatever happens, stuff is spreading. So whether you're on lockdown or not, there is a spread that occurs. And we obviously have till spring or summer to figure out how to get through all this. Let us continue to be part of the solution. Washington State has led in how all of our protocols and capacity restraints and alcohol curfews and all that stuff, we've actually done a really good job of being partners with us. And to turn that back on us is just, it's heartbreaking.
And promises the fight's not over.
Well, I think we continue to press back and say, you're going to kill all of these jobs. Let my people have a job. And if you want to put additional capacity constraints on us, you want to do that, we are part of making stuff.
In Snohomish County, workers at one local sports bar were struggling yesterday, knowing they were about to be out of a job for the second time this year. Many not out from under the debt that they accrued the last time around. They, too, questioned the fairness.
I have not heard of one customer here that has had it. I don't think that it's fair to shut us down.
And with the extra money from the feds they were getting last time around on unemployment now gone, regular unemployment, they don't think will do the trick.
I don't understand why they're shutting us down, and it's going to hurt. I don't know that I'll have a job to come back to, and it scares me.
And Hannah, that seems like a fair criticism. If people can't gather at a restaurant that has taken all the safety precautions, they're probably going to gather at home in unsafe circumstances, right?
Right, and that's actually, I think, what Chad McKay had said to me is that in all likelihood, this might make it worse because we already know that people are gathering there. What we heard, the governor was asked about this yesterday, as was Dr. Lofi, and basically the governor's going off of what worked the first time. Right. They shut everything down, and not having people in the bars and the restaurants was one of the helpful things they thought at the time. The concern is that also that they've learned, Dr. Lofi said, that there's more potential kind of aerosol spread than we thought the last time around. Right. So they just think indoors is bad. And that's why they want to shut anything down that they can.
All right. Hannah Scott. Thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan. And here is CBS senior business analyst Jill Schlesinger to remind us that it's open enrollment time. Why is that so important?
Oh, gosh. Well, I mean, look, we have had so many issues around health. And if this is not the year that you've got to pay attention to your health coverage, gosh, I don't know what is. It's also a year where a lot of people are losing coverage because of job losses or maybe loss in hours. So I think that this is a very important enrollment period for millions of Americans, and paying attention to this and making choices that are not just checking the box to whatever I did last year is good for this year is really important.
Are the various relief measures going to complicate people's tax returns this year, do you know?
Well, I think they could. I mean, look, the CARES Act provisions are probably going to mean that 2020 is going to be unlike 2019, which is going to be unlike 2021. And that's a real tough thing to manage because, for example, if this year your income went way down, maybe you're a gig worker, maybe you're self-employed, and maybe you were able to get your health insurance coverage through a longer term project or a job and you've lost that coverage, now you go to healthcare.gov. And, you know, if it were a normal year, you might have to pay a lot of money for your health care coverage. But maybe because your income is down this year, if you use the Affordable Care Act, which, by the way, is also under open enrollment right through December 15th, mm-hmm. you might qualify to have federal tax credits, which would defray the cost of coverage. So, you know, example, you know, if you're a hairstylist, you might say, well, I went to healthcare.gov last year and it was so much money that I decided to just roll the dice, forget about it. But this year you might find, hey, wait, my income's way down. I actually qualify for tax credits. Now it's more important that I have coverage amid COVID. And now the government's helping me pay for my insurance. So really important to check this out.
Right. A reminder that despite all the debate, the Affordable Care Act is still in effect, so you can still get those subsidies, right?
Yeah. I mean, for about 20 million people, right? And, yeah. And again, millions of people could be losing their coverage this year. Like, for example, if you're an airline worker or you work for Boeing, for example, and you said, well, you know, I might have had a furloughed situation where the company continues to pay for my health insurance, but maybe if I'm no longer furloughed, I'm actually laid off, I lose that coverage. And so that's when it's really important to make sure to weigh the options that are available to you.
Any hint on Congress actually renewing some of the payroll protection program?
Well, I think that there is a real need for Congress to do something. And I think that both sides actually acknowledge that. It's the size of the plan that is the sticking point. So three major components that they're zeroing in on. One is help for individuals. That could come in the form of a stimulus check, right? You could just get that $1,200 check again. It could come in the form, and I think this is what most people believe, most economists think would be more effective, which is the enhanced unemployment benefits and for the benefit period to be extended. That would be really critical part. The next aspect would be help for municipalities. Obviously, the city of Seattle, the state of Washington, under enormous budgetary pressure because of COVID, it really needs help from the federal government to refill its coffers. Without that help, municipalities themselves could be the source of the next round of layoffs. We don't want to see that. And then, yes, some sort of program for small businesses, but I'm not sure what form that's going to take because it may have to just be a grant. It may be that it's a microloan. We don't know, but there are millions of people who are really on pins and needles because we get this great news from Moderna, another great vaccine.
Yeah.
That does not help somebody whose restaurant has seen their revenues plunge by 70 or 80%. They might be forced to close between now and the time that vaccine is widely adopted by Americans.
Okay, but now that Joe Biden's going to be president, I hear rumblings that Republicans are going to rediscover the federal deficit as an issue and might not want to print more money. So give us your perspective on that.
I think it's a nonsense argument, especially for any lawmaker that voted for the tax relief plan in 2017, which added $1 trillion to the deficit, and that wasn't an emergency. Mm-hmm. So the reality is it could be used as an excuse, but I think there's a counterbalancing aspect of this, and that is that these lawmakers have constituents. They've got to go home and face constituents who are looking at dire financial and economic conditions. So I am hopeful that the reality of on the ground, of what's happening on the ground, will push these lawmakers back to the negotiation table. I think the real question is going to be, you know, gosh, is it possible that this is all getting delayed until after that Georgia special election, those two Georgia special elections, yeah. Or will a lame duck Congress take it on?
CBS senior business analyst Jill Schlesinger. Thank you, Jill.
Thank you.
Your Daily Dose of Kindness brought to you by Mike Novak and ListWithNovak.com. A seemingly drama-free webcam stream of a pig in a barn in upstate New York suddenly turned into hot programming when the barn caught fire. Laura Palladino, the sole viewer of the stream, became a hero when she least expected it. CBS's Steve Hartman, the great Steve Hartman, has this incredible story.
Of all the choices, all the places you could click.
Do you see how fluffy that is?
All the videos you could surf. Why would anyone settle on a sleeping pig?
It had to be one of the least interesting things on the internet.
Yeah, she's not putting on a show or nothing. But it was also the least stressful.
With political tensions roiling, all Laura Palladino wanted that Friday night was a boring animal live stream. Unfortunately, her desire for drama-free programming came to a crashing halt after the pig knocked over a heat lamp, buried it in straw, and set the barn ablaze.
And I started freaking out.
And as if that wasn't enough,
I was the only one watching.
The only one in the world who knew what was happening.
Which is what made, like, my heart sink. Like, there was nothing I could do, and it was terrifying. Yeah.
Laura tried calling the farm, but no one answered. She even tried 911. But what were they going to do? She lived 80 miles away. That's why, deep down, Laura knew it was hopeless. But she kept trying different numbers anyway.
And would you believe?
They busted in.
She finally got a hold of the farmer just in time.
I started crying. Like, this is just a lot. And he was, like, holding her. He's like, I'm so sorry. Like, he could tell how much he loved those animals. I was like, oh. Yeah.
Hi, Laura.
Yeah.
This week, Laura traveled to June Farms in West Sand Lake, New York, to meet farm manager Josh Vicks.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Josh had cared for that pig, named Ethel, since it was a piglet.
Definitely inspiring to know that there are other people that feel as much affection and love towards these animals that we do.
The only one uninspired was Ethel herself.
Hi.
Who appears to have emerged from the ordeal completely unshaken. The farm can now proceed with its plan to breed Ethel, promising the first piglet will be named...
Is that good?
Laura.
Never thought I'd have a pig named after me, but I'll take it.
And we'll take her.
Why not?
As a reminder that most people are heroes, just waiting for their moment.
Hi, girl.
I would probably do the same.
I know. Should I ask if the pig is going to be kept as a pet or is the pig going to be, you know?
We don't have an answer for that.
We don't know. Okay.
It sounds like a breeding
Bacon.
Pig, though. I'm not sure. Maybe some of our farmers out there on the text line 98973 can tell us if breeding pigs are also used as food. You know what I mean? Sometimes they separate them out and they're never used as food. But
you know what? Let's not ask. It's a nice story. As
well,
is.
You already did, Dave. You opened that door and I...
And I
let's
ate
just,
it.
No, let's repeat. Steve Hartman says we're all That's heroes right. just all waiting heroes. For our moment.
There you go. Now, from the G and Ursula Show, weekdays 9 to noon, here is G. Scott.
Good morning.
G, I heard on the postgame show that Russell's quarterback rating was 34 yesterday.
Yeah.
So is that the end of the MVP? What do you think?
Well, it's gonna be tough sledding for the MVP, considering Patrick Mahomes has got such a lead now in what his team is doing, and then you got the Pittsburgh Steelers; those guys are 9-0, and you know, right now everybody, you know, last week everybody always wants to blame someone, right? It's always someone else's fault, but at the end of the day, it's a team game, right? It's three phases: offense, there's defense, and there's special teams. And in order for your team or for the Seahawks to be successful, all three of those phases have to be done the right way. Yes, Russell Wilson is the quarterback and a lot of things fall on his plate and on his shoulders, but the one thing that's to keep simple is this: at this time, the Seahawks can't run the ball. And when you go and you look at the stats right now and you see who's rushing, who's running the ball the most, well, right now, people are asking Russell to do everything. He got to cook the food. He got to serve the food. He got to go pick up the food, right? He's passing the ball. Yeah. He's rushing the ball. Yeah. He's got the most rushing yards in this game. The game before that, you had I think it was DJ Dallas had 41 yards rushing. They are not running the football, hence the reason why the offense is one-dimensional, hence the reason why they've turned it over 10 times in a matter of four games. It's uncharacteristic. It's something that Pete Carroll is not used to. It's something that we Seahawks fans aren't used to. But here's what we're seeing. We're seeing Russell in the offense be one-dimensional. You know, this whole let Russ cook. Defenses are saying, you know what? How about that? Go ahead and let Russ cook. We just won't let you guys run the ball. And so when you don't run the ball, you're one-dimensional, and then now you're throwing interceptions, you're having fumbles. It's just uncharacteristic of what we're used to seeing, and you know what? Here we are, Monday, and we took and the Seahawks took an L.
So can we fix it? Can
hey.
We? In time for the Cardinals.
I knew you was going to ask that.
Well, how can I not? Because they were so dominant in the first few games. It can't
Chris
just
Carson.
Be... So Chris Carson has to come back.
Chris Carson is the key, everybody. Now, look, we have been so spoiled with running backs here over time. We with Sean Alexander, Marshawn Lynch, and then even when Marshawn Lynch kind of came back again, but even when Marshawn Lynch was gone, we had this guy by the name of Chris Carson that he doesn't really have the popularity. He doesn't get talked about a lot. But this dude has been really good for the Seahawks, and so much so that we could always count on him. Well, at the beginning of the season, I think the last game he played against the Miami Dolphins, which I thought the offense looked good against them. In that game, Colleen, he had 81 yards rushing. He ran the ball 16 times. Since then, since he's been out, it's been Russell that has been having to carry the load. He had 60 yards rushing one game. I think he had 50 one game. And then you have the new DJ Dallas. He had 41 rushing yards. And then so much so, if you guys saw last night, the leading rusher running back was Alex Collins, who was on the team previous before, and he had 41 yards rushing. So we need, yes, Chris Carson needs to come back. He is really good and really instrumental in this Seahawks offense being great. So I don't know. Hopefully he's back this Thursday.
Why not bring Beast Mode back? Can we just bring him back in the interim?
Now you see, Colleen, you know what? It's that case. Watch. We're going to look on Twitter. Hey, I heard they're bringing Beast Mode back. Colleen O'Brien started that.
Why well, not?
Next man up, right?
So, all right. Yeah, hopefully. Look, guys, look, listen, we can sit here talk to Mark. We're like, we're blue in the face. The crazy thing is today's Monday. They already play on Thursday against a very tough Arizona Cardinals team.
G. Scott with Ursula, 9 o'clock. Thank you, G.
See you guys.
Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to the show's podcast. We're happy you're here.
And you can keep up with the show and find some of the stories from today online at MyNorthWest.com.